We are in Mark chapter 8, and I've entitled this lesson, Follower's Journey. Mark chapter 8, we'll be looking at the latter portion of that, as well as the beginning of, or the first half rather, of chapter 9. Life is a journey. How many would agree with that? Life is a journey, isn't it? It's an image that I think is universally understood. In her biography on the life of John Bunyan, Ola Elizabeth Winslow makes the following comments. She says, man, the wayfarer, the traveler that is an inevitable metaphor and one of the oldest on record. There is something romantic about a journey, whether one has never made one or whether one has sailed all the seas and gazed on a myriad of wonders. Variety, endless change are implicit in the very fact of setting forth. The wayfaring man meets seemingly impassable barriers, makes unwise tarryings, misses the signposts, loses his way, meets strangers who prove friends, encounters dangers of man and beast, experiences delights for which words fail. Whether he seeks adventure, searches for lost treasure, discovers new worlds, or is an exile trying to find his way home, there is always a goal which steadies his thought and strengthens his arm. It's kind of my picture of life there being the journey, probably some highway up in the mountains of Colorado or something like that. Google's a great site to get on for those pictures. Mrs. Winslow here in these remarks that she makes, really she makes them in light of the story that best encapsulates this truth as set forth in John Bunyan's classic, The Pilgrim's Progress. How many have ever read Pilgrim's Progress? A classic story to be sure. It's a great allegorical tale in which we follow Christian, who is on his journey from the city of destruction to the celestial city. And on his way, on his journey, he encounters many interesting places and many interesting people. Places such as the valley of humiliation and death. There's the wicket gate in which Christian encounters the grace of Christ, the fullness of the grace of Christ and salvation. The valley of the shadow is a solitary, lonely place for Christian. There's the hill of difficulty, where Christian starts running up this hill, and then he starts to walk, and then he starts to clamber up and up the mountain. And there, of course, the Delectable Mountains, as you may recall in the story, where he finds rest for his soul. Different people that he encounters. Little Faith. Do you remember Little Faith? The man who was certainly a good man, but really had no heart whatsoever. He encounters Mr. Two Tongues, Mr. Smooth Man, Facing Both Ways. And of course, there's Evangelist and there's Faithful who are always by his side every step of the way. And we've read these stories probably, or read through the story rather, and if we haven't, most of us are probably familiar with the concepts involved in the story. And moreover, we see the immediate correlation, we see the immediate connection between Christian's journey, between his adventure, and that of our own. A journey which is full of ups and downs, a journey which is full of highs and lows, of good and bad, of joy and despair, of righteousness and sinfulness, of pleasant times and of disconcerting and very difficult times, of peace and of anxiety. And each of these things, as they come to our minds, at some time or another, in some way, shape, or form, attend themselves universally, timelessly to the Christian's experience and the Christian's journey. They're always there. And certainly we understand that this journey, the purpose and goal and intention of God along this journey is to produce spiritual maturity. We understand that, don't we? That God is in the business of conforming us to the image and likeness of Christ. That's what He wants more than anything else. And without a doubt, this is the road that every believer travels on. Doesn't matter if you're John Bunyan or any other of our Christian forefathers, down through the course of history, this truth is inescapable. It's universal as far as what we experience. And so with this in mind, as we examine the text before us this morning, it only makes sense that as we encounter the first Christians, the 12 disciples, that we witness this same pattern. As far as Mark chapter 8 is concerned, I forgot to give you the slide there, where we're at. We're at the halfway point of Mark, which is a very pivotal point in the book itself. From this point, all the events move toward Jerusalem. Everything starts to center around Jerusalem. You have the betrayal just ahead. You have the trial, you have the whipping post, and you have the bloody cross that Christ is going to endure for us. And at this time, especially as it's drawing near here, Jesus wants to really reveal His mission, reveal Himself to His disciples in ways that He had not previously done up to this time. And as He does, like Christian, what we're going to witness are really both the highs and the lows of the 12 disciples on their journey with Christ. I've broken the section that we're going to look at, the text rather, into four sections. Each section is going to reveal kind of a high or a low in the disciples' journey, in their adventure with Christ. And as the story begins, Jesus and His disciples are walking through the tiny villages near Caesarea Philippi. We're in chapter 8, verse 27, posing the question. As they're walking along here, Jesus is going to take the opportunity to investigate, to probe, to search out what people think of Him. How is He viewed? And He poses the question in chapter 8, in the latter part of verse 27, who do people say I am? Who do people say I am? Well, the response comes back from the disciples. They replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets. Now, as far as the average person was concerned, Jesus was great. He was impressive. He was fantastic. He was this good deed doer. He was this miracle worker. But He was still classed in the category of the other prophets. He was certainly not the Messiah. And so Christ, now kind of securing the interest of the disciples, poses a second question. I'm getting behind in my slides here. Who do you say I am? All along here, Christ is working, isn't He? He's trying to probe, trying to investigate here. Okay, what does the world say as far as my identity? All right, this is what they have to say. What do you say? What do you think? And you have these 12 individuals, these 12 disciples who have walked with Christ day in and day out for some time now. They have seen and they have heard things that others have not. They have been privy to things that no one outside their ring had any knowledge of. What was their response going to be? How far had their understanding led them to this point? Were they still dull in their senses? We know the disciples, right? Constantly missing the boat. Were they still pretty dull? Was their response going to be the same as the multitudes around them? Well, you can imagine that there's a pretty long pause here when Jesus is asking this probing, this searching question. It's not enough to adopt other people's opinions regarding Christ. Rather, Jesus is asking you to form your own opinion regarding His character, regarding His identity, regarding His nature. And so at this point, Peter steps up, speaking on behalf of the other disciples. Which way is he going to go? What's he going to say? Christ, who has invested time and energy, all this teaching and ministry into the lives of these 12 individuals, could go right down the toilet if they don't make the right response. Katie, I got this for you here. The suspense is killing us. Well, the response. I thought that'd be good. I didn't think any of you guys would understand, but I thought for sure Katie would. But what do you say? He asked, who do you say I am? Peter answered, four words, you are the Christ. In Matthew chapter 16, it goes a little further. He says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. That's it. Man, way to go, Peter. Fantastic. That's the answer. You are the Christ. Now, you're playing eyewitness maybe in some way, shape, or form to this whole event, and you're going, yes, jumping up and down. Peter, you got it. You got it. You're right on. That's exactly what Christ wanted to hear. It must have thrilled His heart to hear His disciple, Peter, say that. And all the others around Him nodding in agreement saying, yeah, yeah, what He said was right. Yeah, you are the Christ. You're the Son of the living God. And to this, Jesus gives a tremendous affirmation to Peter. And we read about that in Matthew chapter 16. Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Now, a question for you. What had Peter said that really prompted such a favorable response from our Lord? What was it that he really said? He said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." But what did he mean by that? What's the significance of the title Christ? Ideas?
Sent one.
Sent one? Okay. What else?
God manifest in flesh.
What were you going to say?
The Messiah was to be the deliverer, so he's the hope, he's the...
Absolutely. What they're saying is, you are the Messiah. You are the anointed one of God. And in essence, what we understand from this is what Peter and the others are expressing about Jesus is the fullness of who He is. In every way. He is God's anointed. He is the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. He is the one who's going to reign from the throne of David in all glory and all majesty and all honor. He is the one. He is the Son of the living God. I've often thought as a teacher, you know, and even before that, certainly when we're asked certain questions, we want to give the right answer, don't we? We always do. Nobody wants to give a stupid answer or the wrong answer, right? You don't feel good doing that. And as a teacher, I learned this with the students. Students would constantly raise their hands and someone would be a little off, but you affirm them, right? Okay, yeah, you're a little off in your answer, or you're out in left field. But it was close, okay? You do that. You're told to do that as a teacher, at least. Beth, you probably understand that to some extent with the sixth graders. But I saw this with my students all the time, the absolute eagerness that they would have to answer the question. And anyone can give the right answer. And my task was constantly, I felt as a teacher, that when students would give the right answer, they would give it not just simply from their head, but they would give it from their heart. That they would truly believe that these things were so. And of course the disciples, as you think about them, could have given the answer that they knew Jesus was looking for. But do you think they knew this guy pretty well? This guy could search right into the very core of your being. He could look right into your heart of hearts and know if what you were saying was what you really believed. And so consequently, Peter and the others who concurred here spoke from the heart. And with this confession, and with Christ's affirmation just mentioned, you've got to imagine that these guys are on the mountaintop. They've done it. They've identified who Jesus is in ways that other people had not been able to do. God had revealed Himself, as Christ said to Peter, in ways that other people had not experienced. And no doubt these guys were feeling good. They were feeling like they were up there on the mountain. Like a student in good stead with his master. And like that old Milwaukee beer commercial, it just doesn't get any better than this. It doesn't. However, just when you think things can't get any better, you can't get any higher, the roof caves in. And as we continue on with the confession of that Peter makes here and the others who are in attendance with him there, Christ begins for the first time to really openly, plainly speak about His messianic mission and what He's going to do. Verse 31, as we continue the story, says, "He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer," yeah, that's the right word, isn't it? "Must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that He must be killed, and after 3 days rise again." Suffer? Killed? What is he talking about? Catch the context. Here's the situation, right? Tremendous confession just taking place. An affirmation given. Christ begins to openly reveal for the first time, it hasn't happened yet, what his mission is, what direction he is going. And here what Christ wants to emphasize to his disciples is he's not here to establish some political kingdom. Nor is he here to conquer Israel's foes, Israel's enemies. He's not here to destroy the Roman oppressors. His mission is that of the suffering servant, as found in Isaiah 53. And the way that he is going to accomplish this seems absolutely preposterous. He is going to accomplish it by death on a cross. Now you pan over to the disciples here. The leaping for joy, perhaps not external but internally, ceases. The laughter begins to fade. The smiles begin to fade. all of a sudden there's this contemplation, this sobriety, this perplexity that takes place. What on earth is this guy talking about? What is he saying? And so what do we have? We have Peter. Peter, who again, speaking up for the multitude, or at least being their representative in verse 32, he spoke plainly about this. Here comes Peter. He takes him aside and he says, you know what? This is really rather interesting what you're talking about here, but come on. This really doesn't make much sense. I mean, really, is this what you're on earth for? Look at you. Look at the ability. Look at the power. Look at the unbelievable superhuman talent that you have. There's no way this is your mission. It's got to be something else. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's madness. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter, "Get behind me, Satan." Imagine those words spoken to you. "Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." You know, when I read that, I go, wow. Ah, wow. I mean, doesn't your heart just go out to Peter here? I mean, for crying out loud, was what he said, did it have to be met with such a stern rebuke? I mean, wasn't his care and concern for Jesus admirable? Wouldn't any friend come along the side of another friend and help them to maybe think a little bit differently, to adjust how they're thinking, if their thinking might be a little off? It's interesting to note that one commentator said, "No sterner rebuke ever fell on any Pharisee than on this disciple of Christ, the first Christian." And then he goes on to add why this harsh rebuke was given. He says, "The avoidance of the cross had been a temptation faced and overcome by the Lord in the wilderness. And for Peter to suggest it here was to think in human terms and not in divine terms." Do you think Christ knew what lay ahead? Do you think he had a pretty clear understanding of the suffering, of the pain, of the torment, of the absolute humiliation that he was going to experience? Do you think being human, he struggled with that? Was he ever tempted to say, "Forget it"? Can you think of a time? The 40 days in the wilderness were constant temptation. Well, we read about temptation as far as turning stones into bread and whatnot. But the temptation was there all along to deter Christ from his mission. Even at the end in the Garden of Gethsemane, what does Christ pray? That the cup what? If it's possible. This guy knew exactly what he was going to experience. He knew exactly the torment, the humiliation, again, as I've mentioned, that he was going to receive. And here's Peter, certainly not possessed by Satan, but unwittingly kind of an instrument in the enemy's hands to deter Christ again from that messianic mission that he has. How quickly we fall, huh? What a slippery slope down from that mountaintop into the valley below. One minute you're riding high, things are good, here's the Christian journey, it's like this. Everything's good. It couldn't possibly get better. The next minute you're going, what on earth just happened? How did I plummet so far? How did I fall so fast? And at this point, Christ calls the surrounding multitudes to himself. He has something very important to say. After he's posed those questions, he's going to talk about paying the price. Verse 34 here, as we're looking at it. "Then he called the crowd to him along with the disciples and said, 'If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with his holy angels.'" Peter and the other disciples around him, nodding in agreement, there, assenting to everything, had just unintentionally attempted to alter the course and direction of Christ's mission. What were they thinking of? Who were they thinking of? Themselves, right? Absolutely. And perhaps the reasoning and the logic was any that we would employ in the situation. If he goes, we go. If he suffers, we suffer. This can't be. This is not why he gave up fishing. Right? I could be back in the tax collector's booth right now making some money. Man, this is not what I signed up for. And so what does Jesus give them to kind of allay their worries and their fears? What does he give them? He gives them the verses we just read. Not necessarily the balm they were looking for, do you think? It flies in the face of most human endeavors and pursuits, namely looking out for number one. What best suits me? What's best for me? What best fits what I want? But Christ speaks of life in ways entirely antithetical to our own. And so in verse 34 he says, you know what? You want to follow me? Then follow me to death. Man. In other words, embrace my life. Embrace it completely. Imitate me. Walk as I walk. Live crucified. Man, if that doesn't rub you the wrong way, what will? What else does he say? He says the losers are the winners and the keepers. In verse 35, for whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Wow, if this isn't opposed to the spirit of the age, I don't know what is. If anything, the spirit of this age says love yourself, pamper yourself, live for yourself, take time for yourself. You are the most important thing, person, whatever it is. And the paradox that Christ speaks of is that those who try to hold on to their life, their physical life, by whatever, amassing material wealth or just holding on to their own ways, are in the end going to lose it. Rather, what Christ wants are people who can say with Jim Elliot, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Just the other week, Kari, was it last week? Was it this week? We were watching the George Lucas. Earlier this week, we were watching George Lucas being honored on America's Film, I think it's American Film Institute, AFI's special that they had honoring George Lucas for all the achievements that he's had in his life. Got a nice little picture here for you. And, they were talking about impact and the impact that this guy has made, and they had person after person talking about, man, he made such an impact on my life. I had a bed sheet that had Jabba the Hutt on it. I had, things that George Lucas had done and impacted just universally through the Star Wars films, through the Indiana Jones films and whatnot. And, of course, there are hundreds of people there to celebrate this man's life and what he's accomplished, something that nobody else had ever accomplished, even in the words of Steven Spielberg, the great director. And yet you wonder yourself as you sit there, what does it all profit? I mean, really, when you look at it, what does it look like down the road? What does it look like after this man's life is gone? What does it profit if he gains the whole world and yet loses his own soul? And it's a sad reality that sets in. Does George Lucas know this? Probably not. But that's the fate that he'll meet for sure if he doesn't turn his life to Christ. Do you think these things were easy to hear? By these people in attendance, by the disciples who were standing there, think they were easy to hear? Man, these cut to the very core of our being, don't they? Even for us to read them now, it's tremendously disconcerting. It's disturbing to see these things. I am trying with all my might to hold the two in tension. I'm trying with all my might to carry my cross. But to deny myself? I just don't know if I can go that far. I mean, I want the salvation that God gives, but do I really want to give up my life completely? No. I certainly don't want to forfeit my soul, but I don't want to give up the things of the world either. And so we're trying to hold these things in balance, and what Christ is saying, there is no balance. It's either me or the world. It's either carrying your cross and denying yourself, or living in this life and losing your life. You can't have both ways. And it's where the rubber meets the road, as KT usually likes to say. And what Christ is saying is the confession of my lordship has to lead to its practice. And ultimately, it has a great price attached to it. It's no picnic, and it's no easy journey whatsoever. So perhaps at this point, the disciples are not doing so hot. Coming down from the mountain a bit, and maybe down in the dumps after what Christ has just said here. But what Christ does next is to show them that while the price is through the roof, while it's extremely high, the reward of following Him is well worth it. And so back up the mountain they go, and literally this time, for Christ to provide some much-needed assurance, some much-needed motivation for them. Chapter 9, verse 2, after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with Him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There He was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah, Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for You, one for Moses, and for Elijah." He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. Verse 7, then a cloud appeared and enveloped them, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is My Son, whom I love. Listen to Him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. And as they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. And here you have 3 disciples, Peter and the sons of thunder, James and John, who catch a brief glimpse of Christ in His majesty and His glory as He's transformed in their midst. I think it's important to note here our understanding of the transfiguration. Transfiguration actually means to change form or outward appearance, which is no doubt what the disciples certainly witnessed. But Jesus is as He is, isn't He? If that makes any sense. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He's immutable. He's unchanging. And as such, it was not necessarily He who changed into something that He had not previously been, but rather it was the disciples' perception of Christ that had really changed. What their eyes were open to was something that they had not seen before. Again, Christ displayed brilliantly, radiantly, glowingly, this manifestation that was entirely unlike what we had just seen, what they had been walking with, who they had been walking with, rather. First Corinthians 13 says, "Now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face." And these 3 individuals, these 3 disciples, Peter, James, and John, were given a gift that the rest of the world won't see until Christ returns. They were given a sneak peek, if you will, at something that we don't see, we don't witness, and we won't witness until we see Christ return in all His glory. And as with anything Jesus did, there's always a purpose that He has in mind. You have to think of these disciples. Think of what they've just been going through. On the mountain with the confession, yeah, things are going good. We've said it right. Jesus is pleased with us. The next thing you know, boom, get behind me, Satan. What's going on here? He's talking about death. He's talking about being killed. He's talking about this cross. He's talking about the payment that has to be made as a disciple of Christ. This is just too much. And perhaps these guys are absolutely reeling from what Christ has just said. Perhaps they're still in shock, even 6 days later, perhaps very wounded by the things that Christ has said. Was He not the Messiah? Was He not the one that was going to lead Israel in defeat over her enemies? What death was He talking about? And the whole point of this transfiguration and in showing the disciples who He is to give assurance. Is to give assurance that they have put their faith and confidence in the right one. Regardless of the price that's going to have to be paid, you follow the right one. You follow the Messiah. You follow God's anointed, the Son of the living God. And to assure them there that His plan and His course is the right one, Moses and Elijah stand with Him. You have both the law and the prophets standing there pointing to Christ. If anything, guys, He is it. And not only that, moreover, you have the voice from heaven, God Himself, God Almighty, speaking down to these individuals. This is my Son, whom I love. Listen to Him. Even as contradictory as it seems, as far as what He's saying, even as weird, as out there, as preposterous as it is, listen to Him. His words are the words of life. You got to love Peter here, just as far as a little aside. He's always got to open his mouth, doesn't he? Oh man, this is great. Instead of closing my mouth and just standing back here, and maybe we should put up some tents. Hello? Are you using your brain? I mean, you love him because he's so eager. But at the same time, he just needs to keep his mouth shut sometimes. Maybe we should put up some tents. Why does he say it? He's absolutely frightened. But what an experience. What a stimulus to keep moving in light of what they had just heard out of Christ's mouth. What motivation, what assurance that this indeed is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Absolutely exhilarating, this mountaintop experience. Certainly more we could say to that, but we kind of need to move along here. So as the disciples head back down the mountain, feeling pretty high again, they're immediately met with this disturbing reality below. And so back down the mountain they come, literally and figuratively speaking. And you think about those mountaintop experiences. You think about how grand they are. You think about seeing Christ. You guys know what I'm talking about. Yeah, I always associate in my mind experiences that I've had the past camp or conferences or whatnot. You're seeing Christ in ways that you had not seen before. In a new light, your eyes are opened. You're illuminated in ways that you had not yet or up to that time experienced. And it's just fantastic. You're riding high. And then the next moment, something comes crashing down, your world comes crashing in, and you're down from the mountaintop. You're down from that experience. And it's constantly the harsh reality of our human condition that's ever before us. And that's what the disciples and Jesus, the three at least, encounter here. Re-prescribing the means. Verse 14, this will make sense in a moment. When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. What's going on here? Here you've got these disciples, the other nine disciples who are left behind are being absolutely heckled, absolutely harassed and ridiculed by the self-righteous scribes. Why? Why are these guys at their throats? Well, an exorcism had been attempted, and the disciples had failed miserably to remove this demon from this small boy. And so the scribes begin to mock and begin to taunt these disciples for their absolute powerlessness, no doubt in the same time defaming the name of Christ. And so Jesus says in verse 16, He says, what are you arguing about? Out of the crowd comes the distraught father of the boy in verse 17. Teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit who has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. What an absolutely wretched picture. If that isn't a pathetic picture, I don't know what is. And here is Satan, constantly at war, trying to destroy the image of God in us. Constantly trying to ruin it, to tarnish it. And out of the depths in verse 19, Christ cries, He says, Oh, unbelieving generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me. Why is Christ experiencing so much frustration, so much pain? In Mark chapter 3, He had sent out the 12, hadn't He? He had given them power, He had given them authority. What happened? What's that?
It worked.
In amazing ways. Well, what's going on here? Why didn't it work this time? What's the situation? Well, the situation is there's an absolute shift from person to process. The disciples are trusting not in Christ, not resting their faith in Him, they're resting in the process. Oh yeah, if we do these certain things or follow these five steps, hey, this guy will get healed. And consequently, what Jesus does is he loops the disciples in with the rest of the unbelieving generation. You're no different. All the things that I've taught you, the power that I've given you, you failed at. And the lesson here very clearly is not that they tried, it's how they tried. It's that they tried in their own strength. They tried in their own power. And the question really becomes, what is the method? What are the means that you are using, that you are employing, that you are incorporating? Where do you draw your power from? Christ had already prescribed the means and the method for all this. He'd already laid it out in Mark chapter 3. But he has to do it again, doesn't he? He has to re-prescribe it. Are you so dull? Did you forget? So they brought him, verse 20. When the Spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the boy's father here as he's kind of assessing things, how long has he been like this? From childhood, he answered, it has often thrown him into the fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. Your heart as a parent, or even as a person, has to go out to this father of this child. Imagine the absolute pain. As a father that he experiences with his child. Imagine that. Imagine how much it's got to hurt to see your son with no relief in sight, day in and day out, be tormented. Probably wouldn't have hit me as hard not having a daughter, but now that I do, it pains my heart. I can't imagine how deeply distraught this father was to see his son like this. And if he says, if you can do anything, if there's anything you can do, and Jesus says in verse 23 here, he says, if you can. If you can. My friend, of course I can. But that's not the issue. The issue, he goes on to say, is that everything is possible for him who believes. I can do this. I can do it in an instant. I can change it all. Because I'm the Messiah. I'm the Son of God. And all power and authority has been given to me. And this is nothing. But the onus is on you. And now comes one of the greatest responses that I think in all of Scripture, in verse 24. Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, I do believe. I do. Help me overcome my unbelief. Don't you love it? I mean, here is an honest, transparent man, if there ever was any. Genuine. Hurting. Trying so hard to believe. Oh, I do believe it. And here's a faith that recognizes its weakness. And so clings to the power of Christ. When Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the evil spirit. You deaf and mute spirit, he said, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said he's dead. Verse 27, but Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. Verse 28, after Jesus had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, why couldn't we drive it out? And to that Jesus responds, this kind can only come out by prayer. And what Jesus essentially says here is the powerlessness that you experience is the result of your self-dependence. Prayer is what you desperately need. We haven't already heard that this morning, right? That's the power source. Prayer is dependence. And it's as we're tapped into that power source that things happen. The disciples, somewhere along the line, had divorced themselves from that, had cut it off, had tried in their own power. Maybe they had seen so many things happen that they said, you know what, we can do this. It's not a big deal. Jesus says, no, you can't. You can't do anything apart from that power source. And again, maybe the disciples are back down in the dumps again. Up and down, up and down. And if this isn't the Christian's journey, I don't know what is. It's an interesting journey, to say the least. Full of ups and downs, highs and lows, twists and turns that each of us experiences on a regular basis. But let me conclude with some things. I've made this point in a previous lesson, but let me make it again here, that the confession of the Lordship of Christ must result in the consistent display of that Lordship. And I found by three things. By the choices we make, by the perception that we operate with, and by the importance we place on our abilities. Stands out to me. Certainly by the choices we make, right? Christ lays them out very clearly. Here are the choices. It's not nebulous. It's not vague. There's no ambiguity here. The only ambiguity, the only warring that goes on is in my own heart. The choice is clear. There's a direction to go. There's a path to get on. Not that it's going to be an easy one at all, but you have to make a choice. You want to save your life, or do you want to lose it for my sake? Do you want to profit from the world? Do you want to lose your soul? Or do you want to profit from me and gain everything? Those are the choices we encounter, and we encounter them on a daily basis. Which way are we going to go? The perception we operate with. What an experience it must have been on that mountaintop for those three individuals as they watched that. They had not seen Christ in that way. And what did it mean for them going down the road? Well, certainly we know that they had some real hiccups along the path to the cross, right? These things didn't really start to come together till after the cross, after Christ's resurrection. Man, this is what he said. It opened up. And so much of our perception needs to be opened up. Because we operate with a fuzzy perception. A vision needs to be cleared. A gaze that needs to be corrected. And it certainly is corrected through the Word of God as we encounter Christ and as we see Him as He really is and as we begin to obediently implement those things into our life that He's asked us to. And lastly, by the importance we place on our abilities. I struggle here constantly. I'm sure we all do. The disciples, again, no doubt, had placed a premium on their abilities. Somewhere along the line after Mark chapter 3, they thought they could do it. We struggle with that day in and day out. The talents, the skills that God has given me, I think somehow are under my control and my power to use, and they're not. God has graciously given them to us. And it's as we're obedient to Him that we see them used in the way that He wants. And so contemplate these things. Think about them. Think about the Lordship of Christ that you've confessed. Like Peter, we have all said, for those of us who are believers, you are the Christ. You are the Son of the living God. How is our lifestyle in comparison to our confession? It's constantly the road before us, isn't it? It's the journey that we walk. And yet the joy is that we follow one who is there every step of the way, to guide us, to lead us, to carry us as we struggle down that road. Father, again, we thank You so much for Your Word. We thank You so much for the challenge that it is to our hearts. God, I pray that it has impact. You've opened my eyes to new things, to things that I probably already knew but was stubborn in my heart in some way, shape, or form not to comprehend. God, there's still so much in me that bucks against this stuff. And I pray that through Your power, through Your grace, you would unleash Yourself powerfully, not only in my life, but in the lives of everyone here. That Your glory would truly be displayed in us. That Your power would be manifested through us to this dark, dark world that so desperately needs You. God, we need You. We're so dependent upon You. Help us in our unbelief that we constantly struggle with. Supply what we need, we beg, and we'll give You the glory in Jesus' name. Amen.